drunk.
No, I didn't.
All right. Erev Tov, good to see everybody. If you're with me in the Gemara, in the Schottenstein edition, we're going to be starting on 2B1. I think we did the first little bit of this, but I want to go back to the beginning of this section where we take a clause of the Mishnah to explore, and we'll talk as we explore this clause of the Mishnah about what's inside the Gemara. And I also wanted to address some questions that I didn't really jump to answer regarding Shushan itself, the nature of its walls. What does it mean when Mordechai sat at the gates? And didn't that sound to us like a regular, typical, good old walled city? And could it be something different? I want to kind of explore what we know about Shushan. The Gemara is then going to get into, I have a feeling we'll get through that section. We'll leave a little bit of the argumentation behind as they're really parsing things through. We'll move to a next section of the Gemara where there is some discussion about the nature of learning the mitzvah of Megillah. Harkening back to some discussion we had before, how do we learn to do a mitzvah from the section of the Bible called Ketuvim? And, by the way, how do we allow for certain kinds of argumentation or rhetorical argumentation in the Gemara to happen with verses from Ketuvim, where we thought we might only apply certain types of hermeneutical argumentation and learning out from the texts in front of us what we need to learn in order to make Jewish law. We might have thought we could only do that with Torah verses, but we see here that we're going way beyond that. And then finally, we'll start a section that will, I think, rise and fall in terms of its being a subject of our Masechta, and that is, we're going to get into the roots, the origins, the history of the Hebrew language. So all that's on the docket tonight, because this part of the page into the beginning of the next is very rich with jumping subjects. They're actually going to leave the conversation of walled cities and maybe come back to it later to try to figure out whose system we actually use and when we're talking about being in a city and whether it has walls today or it doesn't, whose system do we use, and do we say it's a walled city now, do we say it's not a wall? Meanwhile, we're going to start into the text. Clarification question?
Question from last time, it says in the Megillah, Odu Vat Kush, you need to read it. All the cities we see from Odu...
Oh, that was the empire, from Odu Vat Kush.
Cities within this empire should read the Megillah.
Let's say that we have a verse that says, Mehodu ad Kush, the Jews, should do something. Okay?
We in New York don't need to read it.
That the Jews in New York at that time didn't exist yet. The Gemara sees that Jews will be for all time a people on the earth. There will be questions about what cities they live in, whether they should read on the 13th, the 14th, the 15th, and therefore, we're going to use the place of Shushan, perhaps, just as much as we're going to use a place that happened in the ancient world, when the Purim story didn't even happen yet, just like Yoshua ben Nun and Yericho and Jericho. So, they live beyond momentary relationships to places and Jews. Okay, let's go with 2A1 on the right-hand side of the page. 2B1. Right-hand side of the page. If you're in the Steinsaltz translation, we're going to where it says, "Krachim hamukafin choma miyemot Yoshua ben Nun korin b'chamisha asar." Okay. 2b. Okay, that's on 199 in this version. Is anybody using this version just right now? You're using this version, but you're on the Vilna? You're on the Diffus? In the Shas, you're talking about 15, 18 lines down. Got it? Krakim is the first word in the line. So cities that were surrounded by walls at the time of Joshua ben Nun, read the Megillah on the 15th of Adar. Why do we say that they said it was about cities in the days of Joshua ben Nun? There was a Yerushalmi that said, we want to be respectful of the land of Israel, and we want to bring in the notion that in the land of Israel we experience Nes, we experience the miracle, just like we experience a miracle here. So that's the connection. Minahani Mili. From where are these things known? Where do we know that walled cities read the Megillah on the 15th? Basically, there's a parsing out of the verse in 9:21 of Esther that the 14th and the 15th of Adar are the dates of the celebration. So the Gemara is asking, how do we know we should read the Megillah? And how do we know walled cities should read it then? Rava says, Amar Rava, De Amar Kra, the verse says, Al Kena Yehudim HaParazim HaYoshvim Ba'arei HaParazot, therefore the Jews of unwalled places who dwell in unwalled cities make the 14th day of the month of Adar a day of gladness, etc. Midifrazim Ba'arbasar, because you have the unwalled cities particularly indicate in the verse for the celebration on the 14th. I'm going to learn what? Mukafot, Mukafin, B'chamishasar. Walled cities are the 15th of Adar. Now, is that really what the verse is saying? Do I have to necessarily say that if it's the 14th in the unwalled, the 15th of the walled cities? What are some other possibilities?
They also do it on the 14th.
They also do it on the 14th. The verse mentioned the 15th. The verse mentioned the 15th. Do I have to necessarily say it's the walled cities that read on the 15th?
I mean, it implies it. Since it's the 14th and 15th, and it says this group does on the 14th, you might conclude, but we know there's no logic.
Right, so there's a kind of question here. There's going to be a question. The aim of Prazim Ba'arbasar, but you could say that walled, unwalled cities are the 14th, Mukafin Klal Klal Lo, and the residents of walled cities don't have to celebrate Purim at all. That is only out there. That may be the verse's corollary. The law of Yisrael Ninhu. Right? I love this response. This is why I had to start the passage again. Are they not Jews too? You're going to tell them they don't have to celebrate over there? They don't get to celebrate? They don't have to celebrate? Whichever one you want to go with, depending on your attitude towards having another day of Yontif or another day of celebration to make. And V'od, Mahodu V'ad Kush Ketiv. It's written from Mahodu to Kush. Festival Purim is accepted in all the provinces of Ahasuerus' kingdom, which spanned Hodu to Kush. This certainly included walled cities. So did it include walled cities?
The Persian Empire? I would think so.
Right, the Persian Empire had walled cities. So, I just did a little bit of looking around. The word wall is derived from the Latin vallus, meaning a stake or a post. Designated the wood stake and earth palisade, which formed the outer edge of a fortification. The palisades were in use early on and are mentioned by Homer in the 8th century BCE. and later by the Greek historian Polybius, the Chinese historian Sima Quan, among others. Now, ancient walls of Mesopotamia. The oldest walls found in existence so far are those of the temple of Göbekli Tepe in Urfa, southeast Turkey, which date to 11,500 years ago. City walls, which became common for purposes of defense, are first seen around the city of Jericho around the 10th century BCE. And the Sumerian city of Uruk, which was founded somewhat later, though both cities lay claim to the honor of the first city in the world. The walls of Uruk were thought to have been built by the great king Gilgamesh, upon which he inscribed his heroic deeds, which formed the basis for the later epic he is most famous for. Walls began to rise around cities throughout Mesopotamia shortly after urbanization began in the region around 4500 BCE. City walls were constructed to include gates and watchtowers, and usually a ditch running around the outer perimeter of the wall, which could be filled with water. King Hammurabi surrounded the city of Babylon with more impressive walls than usually seen shortly after he assumed the throne in 1792 BCE. But the credit for transforming the city of Babylon into an awe-inspiring wonder belongs to King Nebuchadnezzar II, years being 634 to 562 BCE. Built three walls around Babylon at heights of 40 feet and so broad at the top that chariots could race around them. Obviously, we saw here in the lecture the Ishtar Gate and the wall of Nebuchadnezzar II's Babylon, claimed by some to be greater than any of the listed wonders of the ancient world. And thought that the Sumerian king Shulgi of Ur was 155 miles long, built between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers to keep the invading Amorites out of Sumerian lands. And then Shusin, Shulgi's son, has the wall breached by the Elamites in 1750 BCE. And it's important for us to recognize that the Elamite region, for us, and I wanted to get us there, because the Elamite region is the region where you have what most people say definitively, is ancient Shushan. Some hold that the district of Shushan is a little bit west of where Shushan is today. Susa was the ancient way we called the city Shushan. But obviously, in these lands, at the time of Ahasuerus and the Purim story, you would have a ton of these walled cities, if it was Mahodu Ad Kush. That's the major point. Now, I want to just hand you around the handout for tonight. The top page, one of my handouts for tonight, the top page is what I'm referencing now in terms of map. If I may, just slide those over, Barry. So this is a page from the Carta Bible Atlas, which is also the Macmillan Bible Atlas. The same four author editors did the work. This is the page on the return to Zion, where both Esther and Ezra are quoted in terms of the biblical anchor points, the moorings. And you see in this one, in the center of the page, map number 168, that you have these districts that are articulated in terms of ancient Persia. And you see that Shushan, number two, is kind of like at the meeting point of the Tigris and the Euphrates, right? But that's most likely because there was a district called by that name. And Susa, Shushan itself, up on 167, take a look at where it is. It's just a little bit east and north of that spot, right? Same page up on top, 167, map 167. Right? See Susa? Right side, like look at the box where 167 is.
Not just Middle East.
No. Right.
Because if you see the Tiger, the Euphrates, the river, it's like...
Right. So the point being that Susa is, by all standard accounts today, the actual place we're talking about. So in terms of thinking about Susa itself, the idea is that you either understand it to be a walled city, like Persepolis. It was moved. The great leaders during the time of this period of the Bible, where the page is from that you're holding, moved, as I was reading over the last couple of days, they moved the capital to Susa, that which became Shushan for us in the biblical writings. And then the question is, did they actually build it up with such walls as we figure Nebuchadnezzar did in the hyper kind of way he did, or any kind of walls that were fortress type of walls that were either preceding Nebuchadnezzar or came after? Or did the walls that we're talking about in Shushan really become the walls of a palace and a great palace site and look a little bit like what a walled city would look like, but not actually create the footprint of a major urban center with great walls? And the reason why I talk about that is because there are a few books that have been published as of late, you know, in terms of bringing together archaeology and the Bible and what we can put our feet down on the ground, and using photographs and using objects in museums and linking our biblical understandings with these things. So one of the great ones that's come out, I think, in the last couple of years is a book first published in 2010 by a licensed tour guide who's a religious gentleman who's also an archaeological expert named Yehuda Landy. And this book about Purim and the Persian Empire gives, on page 24 and goes on for several pages, a little bit of the story of Shushan. He has an aerial view of ancient Shushan here. The impressive remains of Ahasuerus' palace are clearly visible. This is what scholars are agreeing it came from that time period. The small castle in the foreground was built by the French archaeological mission to Shushan while excavating there over a century ago. So it gives you some sense of scale to have this French castle sitting in front of the site. And I'll hold it up and then I'll pass it around. But what's amazing about it is you have this castle here and then you have this entire site. And if you think about Mordechai sitting at the gate, Ron, I think you mentioned the other day, but wasn't it a walled city? Didn't Mordechai sit at the gate? It could have been very well, and this is not definitive at all, that Mordechai sat at the gate of the king's palace, and that the walled nature of Shushan was, Shushan as the walled capital, was the palace of Ahasuerus, but that the whole city was a lot more like flatland suburbia than a walled city a la the great walled cities of the ancient world that you literally kind of go inside the gates. So it's really an interesting book, and at least take a look at the photo to get a sense of what we're talking about in the best way that we can there. So our Mishnah is obviously going and relating this back to walled cities at the time of Yehoshua ben Nun. We do have, as I mentioned in the article that I read to you, archaeological evidence that there were walls there. The conquest itself is another story, by the way. There's a great article in Biblical Archaeology Review about the conquest of Jericho. more evidence today than there was when it first was being thought about by archaeologists in terms of, yes, a conquest might have happened there, than no. But there was pretty much unanimity that we had no great archaeological evidence for it. You had to take it on the faith of the Bible. And now that's becoming a little bit more known to us through some of the findings. A little bit more evidence that it really may have unfolded the way it did, either exactly like in Yoshua, or that at least some archaeological evidence that there was a city there. The problem was with Jericho and the days of Joshua was that you didn't have a layer of city life in Jericho in the tell, in the main tell. You had to kind of go further. But we went further. So we were able to find. Anyhow, so back to the administrative regions. Since it says from Hodu to Cush, I'm on the top of 2b2, if you're with me in the Schottenstein edition of the Gemara, that everybody's a Jew. It says from Hodu to Cush, everybody's got to read the Megillah. And there are walled cities there, and we need the law about the walled cities. And so we need to say it's the 15th, and it's not the 14th. Ve'ema prazin ba'ar beisar, mukafin ba'ar beisar uvachamesar. But let's say that the walled cities could read either the 14th and the 15th. Kedichtiv, as it's written, lihiyot osim et yom arba'asar l'chodesh adar, ve'et yom chamishasar b'chol shana. Let them observe the 14th day. They should observe the 14th day in the month of Adar and the 15th day of the same each and every year. If it only said 14th and the 15th without the et and the et in the Hebrew, I might have said, okay, you could have your either or for walled cities. But since it makes a distinction between the 2 days, and it says the et Arbasar, the 14th for unwalled cities, I'm going to say that the Ve'et says about the 15th that you have to actually read the Megillah in the walled city on the 15th. The Gemara poses yet another challenge to this whole scriptural derivation. Ve'ema prazin ba'arbasar, and one could say unwalled cities should read the Megillah on the 14th. Mukafin, and the residents of walled cities may choose when. Let them choose whether it's the 14th or the 15th. Oh, Gemara rejects that possibility and says, Amar Krab is Zmanehem. The verse says in their times, which teaches that what? Zmano Shelzeh, hello Zmano Shelzeh. I'm going to take that word Zmanehem and say, but that grammatical construction, that is demonstrative of the fact that I have a distinction between the days on which I read, 14th for unwalled, 15th for walled. What's interesting about that point? We'll say in to revisit Bobby's question. Bobby asked, but wait a minute, I thought that they already were arguing about that word, Bismanehem, in their times, in another drush, and they were even arguing that it couldn't use it for that because it needed it for a different one, and he had a different day to say that you extended the amount of time you could read the Megillah, because you not only have 14, 15, you have 11, 12, 13, right? Well, here, no problem. The rabbis don't, quote-unquote, hold themselves to the system where, since we already talked about it on page 2A, I can't talk about it on 2B. They're going to use the word. They're going to go ahead and learn from the word what they need to learn. And the word that they're going to learn from is Bismanehem again. Since it said Bismanehem, I have to make a distinction. This one is unlike that one. The time for reading here is not the time for reading there. Same as Tlesar, but one could say that in walled cities, Purim is celebrated on the 13th of Adar. Ah, what basis exists for assuming that walled cities celebrate Purim on the 15th? The Gemara answers, Keshushan. Presumably, walled cities celebrate Purim on the same day as the city of Shushan. Since the verse is given no date for the walled cities, we assume that they celebrate Purim on the 15th, the day when the residents of Shushan celebrated after defeating their enemies. What's the nature here of Shushan then, according to the Gemara? Walled or unwalled? Wait, listen again. Ve'emar b'tleisar. Let's say it's the 13th. Let's say it's the 13th of Adar. Oh, But what basis exists for assuming that walled cities celebrate Purim is really the question, on the 15th as opposed to the 13th. The Gemara answers, well, it's Kishushan. It's like in Shushan.
But Shushan celebrated the day after the winning the war, so to speak.
Either Shushan, it's an either. Either Shushan is walled, and it's like Shushan, therefore walled cities is the thing I'm concerned about. And they read like the 15th. Or I say Kishushan because I'm including Shushan with all the walled cities that were walled in the days of Joshua. I'm starting to get a little fuzzy here on whether or not Shushan is actually the 15th because it was a walled city, or like with Shushan where they celebrated the 15th, I rope that in with the walled cities in the time of Yoshua ben Nun. Because if I don't want to learn from you, Zmani, cities that were walled in Zman Yoshua in the time of Joshua, I can learn from Shushan, which is on the 15th they celebrated. I'm not entirely clear that I have to say Shushan is walled at this point. That's my point. The Gemara says.
So, when the Mishnah is talking about walled cities in the time of Yoshua ben Nun, they're referring only to cities in the land of Israel?
No. They're referring to any city that's walled in the time of Yoshua ben Nun. And when the Jews had salvation from God and help from God to conquer the city of Jericho, we pay tribute to that moment of miraculous reality. And if a city was walled during that time, even if it's not walled now, we still say you read it on the 15th there.
Perhaps Shushan didn't exist at the time of
Yoshua. Right. Perhaps it didn't. That's why Kishushan becomes a different kind of reasoning at this moment in the Gemara. The verse from which we derive that the date for unwalled cities is the 14th and for walled cities is the 15th discusses the festive aspects of Purim, not the reading of the Megillah. Back to the question, how do we really learn to read it? The Gemara therefore asks how we know that the Megillah reading also takes place on these dates. In other words, now what we're going to do is we're going to say, I might have a reason for the 15th reading of the Megillah, and that reason might be because the city was walled in the days of Yoshua, or I might say that it's because of the victory in Shushan, walled or unwalled. It was because of the victory of Shushan. But by the way, now let's stop for a minute. We've been talking all this time about where we know from the 14, 15, we expand the day, 11, 12, 13, we're going to read the Megillah. Wait a minute. Where did it say read the Megillah? So now we're going to get into that. Ashkechan Asiya, we find that the celebration took place, that they made the celebration, Asiya, that they did it. Zechira Minawan. Remembering, commemorating, or remembering Zechira. From where do we know to do that? Now, it's an interesting question in and of itself by way of the Gemara, in terms of how I'd just like to stop for a minute and say, the setup is understood at this point in Gemara language to be Kriyat HaMegillah, because Rashi says in about the middle of the page, if you want to just see Rashi's two words on it, Rashi says, Zechira, and on Ashkechan Asiya, the Mishteh v'yontov shetehei lefrazim b'yodal u'mukafim b'tu. Rashi says, there will be a yontiv, there will be a celebration, and there will be lots of drinking and partying on the 14th and the 15th in their respective places. Zechira. The word Zechira in the Gemara, if I just said to you without really taking Rashi's tradition and now the translations in front of us, their tradition of Rashi, using that for the translation, what might we have said could be Zechira in terms of a physical, actual act of Zechira that we would do for Purim? If I didn't have Rashi's tradition on the page here of how to read this Gemara, how do Jews remember things? We have physical phylacteries that we remind ourselves with. Is that what you said, Tefillin?
No.
What did you say?
No, I said Tefillah.
Oh, Tefillah. Okay. So A, you have Tefillah, just simply a prayer, like you have an insertion for something, and you remember the day. Ala Nisim, for instance. You have about the miracles that God wrought for us in the days of Mordechai and Esther, in the Modim prayer, in the Amida. You might have thought, reading this Gemara, if I had nobody helping me, wait a minute, is that what they mean? Because remembering it is remembering it in my mind as I pray. So that's one possibility. I already gave away my other, I thought you hit upon. I could have made something physical. What kind of physical something could I make to remember the day?
Mishloach manot.
By sending packages of goods to my friends, I could just say that that's for Zechira, that's for remembering the day. Right? How else do we remember people?
People
and events. We fast, we give tzedakah, we light candles. We have a lot of different ways that I could actually translate Zechira. The point I'm making is that you can't read Gemara without Rashi. You just have to have, Rashi is your friend. The tradition, I mean, we could get it because of context and push on into the text and see that they're talking about Kriyas Megillah. We could. But it's so nice to have Rashi just fill you in, idiomatically, the way that Steinsaltz does in modernity. And he says that Zechira is Kriyas Megillah. I just think that there's power, too, in just stopping and noticing before we read the rest of the sugya, that if Zechira, if remembering, is actually reading a Megillah and rereading text and doing it in a performative way, that the idea of performative textuality and reading a text of our Bible in a public assembly of sorts, in and of itself, outside of tefillah, even if you didn't have prayers per se, that could be as much of an ancient way that we got together in an assembly as the ancient rites of saying the Amidah or reading the Shema. The notion that we got together to recite texts that retold the stories of who we are was different than other cultures where they got together to hear oral recitations thereof or dramatic representations thereof. The nature that we had scrolls and text and recitation in a certain way with certain words, with a systemic translation into the local language, this was all part of the culture that's being built up. So Zechira, remembering, becomes a performative textuality. Very just interesting to think about by way of when we say we remember what we do.
So when you say Zechor Asher Aseh Lecha Amalek, what is our obligation for this Zechor? How we remember this?
We read it. And reading that passage becomes, for the rabbis, what's called and considered a deraita mitzvah, a Torah-itic mitzvah. You can't miss it that day. Many communities not only have the first reading during shul, they'll have another reading after Kiddush, and then they'll have a reading in the afternoon of that passage so that everyone in the community can come. Family couldn't get there because of their children in the morning, family members come later.
So, but Rashi says that you are supposed to read it.
Right.
Not that you're supposed to listen to it.
Well, the zechira of the community is that someone would read it, and obviously those who are listening are going to have it fulfilled.
But he said read it, that we all have to read it.
Every one of us. Interesting.
Yes. Couldn't you?
Sure. That's it. That's
but you're not allowed to read it alone.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah, I think so.
You are allowed to read the Megillah out loud to yourself.
Somebody needs to listen that you read it correctly.
Not with a Megillah. It's interesting, we say that with a Torah reading. We have two gabbais. But you can be makri latznecha. You can read the Megillah out loud to yourself.
Because if you read it alone and you didn't read it right,
you run the risk. That's why we have the nikudot. That's why we have versions with the vowels, and we don't just, you know, read it from the scroll so that you can practice. Right? If it was only an oral tradition and I had no versions with the vowels, then I'd really have to make sure that I've got the right, you know, transmission of tradition. But since I have versions, I can really practice and get it right.
So the whole issue of the days was because some people didn't know how to read, so they got together in the places that there is somebody to read.
Yeah, that, and you could so, say it's from simply a chisaron like that as well.
So it's a conflict of...
you could say. But let's see where it's from. According to the Gemara, where is this from that I have to read the Megillah? So we're going to say that Amar Kra, that the verse says, V'hayamim ha'ele, these days, nizkarim v'na'asim. The verse states, these days shall be commemorated and celebrated. Eat kash zechira la'asiya. And by the juxtaposition of one to the other, commemoration is compared to the celebration, and celebration to commemoration. It teaches that the activities of commemoration take place on the same day as the celebration. Did I really answer how the verse explains particularly that you have a whole Megillah? No, just but it said, since you're making a celebration on that day, then you have to also do what's called Zechira on that day, and we understand Zechira as being reading the text, and therefore we do it the same day. Mishnah taught that cities must have been walled at the time of Joshua to read the Megillah on the 15th. The Gemara cites a dissenting view. Matnitin de lo ki haitana. Very important technical term in the Talmud. That is, our Mishnah is not in accordance with the opinion of this other Tanaitic teaching. Remember, a Tana is of the period of the writers of the Mishnah, the rabbis who taught early on. I have another Mishnaic or Brita, an outside text that's not in the Mishnah. I have another teaching from the same era of rabbis that now challenges the way that the Mishnah puts it forward. The Mishnah said 15th, you read it on the 15th if you were in a walled city, days of Yoshua. Right? Now it's going to say, I have a different tradition. What's my tradition? It was taught in a Brita. Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha Omer, Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha says, Krakina mukafin choma mimot achashverosh, korin b'chamishasar, that walled cities in the days of who? Achashverosh. They are the ones that read it on the 15th. Gemara asks, my Talmud, Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha, what's Rabbi Yeshua's reason for determining the status of a city by the existence of a wall at the time of Achashverosh? The Gemara answers, ki Shushan, because a walled city must be like Shushan. Ma Shushan ukepet choma mimot achashverosh, at least to the Gemara's definitive opinion, the Shushan is a city that had walls around it. Vikorin b'chamisha asar, and its residents read the Megillah on the 15th of Adar. Af kol shemukafet choma mimot achashverosh, so to any city that's surrounded by a wall at the time of achashverosh, korin b'chamisha asar, actually, you can read it on the 15th of Adar. Makes sense, right? Seems to make more sense to this Tana. Is it not more logical to actually ascribe the time to here? Gemara turns to the Tana of our Mishnah and says the following. V'tana didan, my Tana. And what's our Tana's reason then? Why would our Tana teach that it's about the time of Yoshua bin Nun if this one seems to be pretty straightforward? Yalif Parazi Parazi. He derives it by means of a Gezeirah Shava. I have 13 hermeneutical principles, 13 ways of reading a text according to the Brita of the famous Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Yishmael explains to us there are certain ways of reading the Torah and the scriptures where if I compare one word here to another word there, it's called a Hekesh or a Gezeirah Shava, and I learn from one verse or word in the Torah to another verse or word in the Torah that is parallel language, and since I learned something back over here, it must mean the same thing over here. So he says, our Tana, our Mishnaic teacher, had a Gezeirah Shavah. He had a tradition of learning that the word in our verse in chapter 9 in Esther matched up with a word in a verse in the Torah. And because they match up, he's going to learn about the glory of the days of Israel and keep alive the days of glory of Moses and Joshua when it comes to understanding the days of glory of Mordechai, Esther, and the Jews of Shushan and Purim. And for that reason, I say that we read it in walled cities, not like Shushan, but I go back to the city of Jericho, where Joshua ultimately experienced Kibush Haaretz, the conquering of the land. That is the Hekesh. That's the Gezeirah Shavah. Says, Prazi, Prazi. K'tiv hacha al kein hayudim ha-prazim. Here it's written, therefore the Jews of unwalled towns. That's the word prazim. That's our unwalled towns. That's our Jews of the Persian Empire. V'uchativ hatam. And it's written over there. That is Deuteronomy 3:5. That's describing the territories conquered by the Jewish people on their way into Eretz Yisrael. Levad me'are ha-perazi. Harbe me'od. And elsewhere it's written, besides a great number of unwalled towns. Malahalan mimot Yoshua bin Nun. Just as there it means a town that was unwalled at the time of Joshua bin Nun. In terms of Deuteronomy. Afkan mimot Yoshua bin Nun. Here too it means what? When I see the word in our verse in the Megillah, Hayehudim haperazim, I think to myself, oh, the Jews that are in unwalled cities that are in the time already from the time of Yehoshua and not Ahasuerus's time.
It's only used one time? That word is only used one time? Or they chose that?
Those are the two verses. I cannot with 100% certainty say it's not used elsewhere. The root.
Three prazot is few times in Bamidbar.
Yeah, but actually as unwalled cities, I think it's three times. I think it's once in Bamidbar, I think it's once in Deuteronomy, I think it's once in Esther. But don't hold me to it.
So the interesting thing though is it's three times. I don't know if it always means the same one. So maybe they're making a...
It definitely meant the same thing back then as well. So in this case it did. You're right that sometimes the Gemara wants to say, wait a minute, didn't we have that word and see it mean something different over here?
Right.
You know, some people, and Rishonim sometimes bring that out. So far, I can say that my Tana, our Mishnah, differs from Rabbi Shimon Korcha, because Korcha wants to keep it in the days of Ahasuerus, but the Gezeirah Shavah allows our Mishnah, our teacher in the Mishnah, to teach that it's really linking us back to the walled cities in time of Yeshua. And you recall that we said our Tana is Rabbi Akiva, who was the Stima'a, who wrote Stam Mishnah. And Rabbi Akiva, of course, was among those who really celebrated the taking of the land and wanted to even further take the land. And we have a certain sense that Akiva wants to connect us with our desire to take the land and our desire to be Israel, no matter where we are. Allah, thinking about what I termed writing Israel onto the diaspora. Why our Tana disagrees with the view of Rabbi Yoshua ben Korcha? Why will he not say that it is from Ahasuerus, Zaman Ahasuerus, the time of Ahasuerus? Ben Korcha is a Tana from a little bit of the later era when they were actually giving smicha. If he lived exactly the years of Rabbi Akiva, I don't know. Bishlama Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha lo amar katana didan. We understand why Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha did not say, as our Tana did, that a city's status is dependent on the existence of a wall in the time of Joshua. Delayt late prazi prazi. he didn't have a tradition of the Gezeres Shava to learn that the root Peres Zion over here in Deuteronomy matched up with the Gezeres Shava with the word over here in Esther, and that was considered an official Gezeres Shava. Because there's a tradition that you only have a Gezeres Shava from your teacher by his time. In other words, that he must have inherited that limud. And since he didn't have it, he can't learn it like that.
It has to begin somewhere.
It has to begin somewhere is the logical argument. But in this case, since Rashi explains that he didn't really have it mirabo and he couldn't just create it himself, then we say that this isn't the time.
We have the same tradition with the kashrut. Because I remember reading about whether or not locusts are kosher enough. And the answer was, in certain cultures, locusts are, are kosher, because it says it's kosher in the Torah. But it's only kosher in cultures in which there's an unbroken chain of eating locusts as a kosher food.
Yes.
And therefore, so you know, which, because it's only certain locusts that are kosher. So you need this unbroken chain of continuity to be confident that you've got the right thing. So this seems like an analogy that if you don't have someone linearly transmitting this wisdom or knowledge, then there's fear that it'll be misunderstood.
Right.
Because of the break in the chain.
Right. And the wisdom not being really there and insufficient enough, by way of indicating which locus, is a little bit like the wisdom knowledge not being there by way of really being able to make this hekesh, this comparison of the verse, because there was a fear, according to some, that you couldn't really make this hekesh between a verse from the Torah and a verse from the writings. That you didn't really want to make a hekesh with a verse that came all the way from this section of the would-be Tanakh and this Torah section. That it seems like it's either easier from Torah to Torah. That's the most accepted. Sometimes you have a word from Nevi'im.
So maybe they didn't accept the Megillat Esther as part of the Tanakh.
We've talked a little bit about the notion of canon and making canon. Moreover, there were people who were, obviously it was a little bit more fluid by way of ascribing any kind of authority to the text and using parts of the text to bring together what we say about it. Now, a little bit like scholarly journal versus Discover Science magazine. Which one would we want you to use in order to make some hypotheses for your research? Citations and tests and this and that. A little bit unlike that, though. Because the notion that all books have a certain sacred status, regardless of their spot in the Tanakh, we saw already from last year, those of us who learned Shabbat, Parak 16, 16th chapter, where all of the books in our Tanakh had that status of save them and treat them as kadosh. And the mitzvot that we learn from prophets and writings, though they are less than the Torah texts, we still have some. So that's a little bit of what's going on, but the background is more about the transmission of the particular limud here, the word limud meaning a tradition that allows me, in this case, to read our texts and teach a Mishnah with a definitive outlook concerning them, where I see the word and I have to translate it with a certain meaning attached to it. Because if I really have that, the meaning attached to it is that this word implies unwalled cities from the time of Joshua.
But it can't be utilized. It only has been utilized, but even if you make the connections, you know, as someone who's studying and someone who is trying to find insights, you really can't utilize that. It was valid to be done in some tradition, but it can't be reconstituted because it would be novel or a new insight, and you can't add.
Well, at the end of the day, we're both open and closed. You know, at the end of the day, we're both open and closed. Someone might have a new insight about how to make tefillin. But in order to make kosher tefillin kosher, we really
that's
don't... I don't know, Bobby, because we reinterpret...
You're not asking everybody to make tefillin. You're only asking them to consider a connection.
No, but we're asking them to consider what is like to put totafot beninecha. So let's say that someone comes along and really has a really serious study about totafot beninecha.
To study and to look for meaning.
No, but this is about observance too, because remember that the context here is, if I live in a city and I want to have a practice, if a city is from the time of a Ahasuerus or Walt city, that's different than my
that's
city being...
That's a particular word, but I thought you were saying that you can't do this,
The Gezeirah Shava.
That unless it has already a tradition in terms of comparing words and trying to get new meaning because
yes.
of the word.
So it might be a loss of precision. It doesn't mean you can't say I was reading this and reading that and here's what I learned or here's something meaningful.
Right. So it is more about a halachic ruling where the rhetoric is used to say, sorry, that wasn't around. But for meaning making, you're right, that there's a little bit more openness. And by the way, the argument that we've already either we've never seen that one or we have that one and it's different or yeah, you're right. It's not necessarily always rejected because we never saw it before. In other words, I'm sure at some point in the Gemara's use of Gezeirah Shava that like Jay's question and spirit of yours, now is the moment where this is really happening.
Well, the halachic decision is quite consequential, so that's...
Yeah.
What we look at right now, I mean, first of all, the whole idea of Torah and Sora, you are receiving from somebody who came before you and knows something he can teach you. You can't allow it and interpret it. I'm not saying you could, but in our tradition, we don't go to the library, as you pointed out, and say, I just had a revelation. I have a whole new way of looking at things. You're part of a community and that knowledge is transmitted directly, but you got to tell it to we have many different traditions in Judaism where the transmission has, as my daughter-in-law said to my wife, what? How do you make a seder without rice?
Right.
So we're kosher, we're kosher. But nobody told them that you can't do, you can't eat that.
Right.
This seems like a perfectly normal thing.
All right, there's a fine line here. There's a balance, right? Somebody has a great new practice that they want to try in the hospital, and they've seen it enough times to know. Even they're conversant with the equipment, with the medication, with the procedure, and then they say, "I'm going to start this anew." Right? There's a life on the line. The rabbis felt the same way about our souls. They weren't just upending things and starting something new because eureka, I found it. But maybe in a certain moment or two a religious genius did. But then they would really have to worry. Am I uprooting the Torah? And we have a principle, Eit Lahafer Torahtecha. There's a time to uproot the Torah. There's a time to uproot the teaching. Right? But what do you do when you uproot something in a planting and a replanting? So be careful about how you uproot. Right? I can see my teacher, Rabbi Benzion Bergman. He says, it's really tempting to take that little line, Eit Lahafer Torahtecha. There's a time to uproot everything. Right? But if you just uproot it all, and you don't consider some of the plants, keeping them nice with roots, and that you're going to replant them, and and create the next generation, you're dead. So that's the tension. That is the tension. And certain traditions last longer in certain eidot, in certain communities, rice, not rice, Ashkenaz, Sephardic. And we press on and we find a way to understand halachically the distinctions. And we say the distinctions and we say they're not loopholes, which we've talked about before too. That they're distinctions about how to live life of Torah as opposed to just making an end run around them. Okay. So what I want to do is I want to say that they go through a little bit and they try to understand whether or not they're really learning from Rabbi Yehoshua ben Korcha in terms of the days of Achashverosh and look at 2b4 with me. I'm skipping down a little bit in the Gemara where it says Rabbi Yehoshua ben Korcha Amar Lach Rabbi Yehoshua ben Korcha on 2b4 if you've got the art scroll. And right. Amar Lach Rabbi Yehoshua ben Korcha. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Korcha could say to you, and is the verse understandable according to our Tana? Even according to our Tana, the verse is problematic for the following reason. In other words, our Tana is going to have a problem. Kevan de itle prazi. Because our Tana holds that the Gezer Shava that links unwalled towns to unwalled towns from Deuteronomy over to the Megillah. Medina, Medina, Lamali. What purpose is served by the phrase Medina, Medina? Because remember that afterwards in the Megillah, I had the mention of Medina, Medina, ir va'ir. Province, province, city to city. And they're trying to work out like what to do with all of these words that I could learn about what I do in cities from and what I do in different provinces from. It only reiterates the same ruling. One must conclude, therefore, that the purpose of this verse is not to differentiate between the types of cities. Ela karala drashahu da'ata. Rather, the verse comes to serve as a basis for some other teaching. So where you're going to try to learn what you need to about cities from Medina, Medina, ir va'ir, province, province, city to city, ben korcha, the Tana, who's teaching that it's about cities in the days of Joshua, I'm going to tell you that those words come for different purposes, and they come for different purposes to make drushes. And it says, "Uchad the Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi hu da'ata." It's like what Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi taught. Rabbi Amar, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi said, "Karach lechola samuchlo." That those say it's about the city and everything that's kind of right around it. A walled city is everything that and everything that's near it. Vechol hanire imo, and everything that can be seen with it. Nidon kichrach. That's judged as if it was a walled city. So not only does the walled city itself celebrate Purim on the 15th, but so do all the open towns and settlements around it. So Jerusalem, the old city, reads the Megillah on the 15th, right? But does the rest of Jerusalem, the new city, read it on the 15th? Yes. The answer is yes. In relation to this last halacha, the Gemara then says, Ad kama, how far can a settlement be from a walled city and still be considered near the city? In other words, now, okay, let's become land surveyors. You want to give me a sense of what you mean by the lands and places around it, suburbs around it. Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah Eitem Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, Rabbi Yirma said, and Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba said the following, Kamechamtan Latveria Mil. The equivalent of the distance between Chamsin and Tveria is 1 mil, 1 mile. And so here you get a certain sense of how we established the ancient mil, the ancient Roman mile, which becomes here the rabbinic mile. Balema meal, let him just say 1 meal. Why did Rabbi Yirmiyah also mention that's equivalent to the distance between Chamsa and Tveria? Ha kamashmalan de she'ura de meal, kama ave. That teaches us how long a meal really is. Kamechamtan le Tveria is the equivalent of the distance between Chamsa and Tveria. Now, did they actually come up with that, l'chatzkila, the rabbis, and say, that's the meal, and therefore define it? Or could it have said, and by the way, I also heard from my local Roman compatriot that when they're measuring distances, they call on the road from this place to that place, one meal. In the background, you have to remember that that system of distances is becoming part of the whole landscape there. The Romans have their distances. Alexander the Great, when he conquered, had different kinds of ways of measuring distance. And so we get a sense of which culture they're established in. But anyway, if you say that from here to here is one, you know, meal, and all those suburbs of walled cities are included, that lets us know halacha lemaase today, in today's kind of thinking, and this is where creativity doesn't really break our back, right? Doesn't uproot us entirely. That if I have suburbs of a certain city, and I really call myself a suburb of a certain city, and it was walled at the time of Joshua ben Nun, then I'm going to say, hey, halachically we should read the Megillah when? 15th. So that's really where the Gemara goes with this whole discussion. It says the walled city and its environs, because at the time that they're actually making the halacha regarding reading the Megillah, we're no longer sitting over there in Shushan. Where are we? We're in Eretz Yisrael. Some of us are living in Babel. Maybe a few Jews are still living out there. Definitely a community in Alexandria, in Egypt. So we have to know.
Is there a list of the cities that were walled at the time that they can refer to now?
I don't have that list.
How many do you think it might include?
I think it basically...
I can't say I know...
Metropolitan of that area. So maybe Mecca, or maybe Medina, and maybe Shushan. Big cities with surrounding, probably that's what those cities that exist at that time. Jerusalem.
In the Torah, the one place that I remember where the distinction of being in a city is the Great. And there, the presumption has to do with whether or not there's sufficient density that if the woman yelled, someone would have heard her. And that presumes quite a high density of population, which doesn't seem to me to be met by this environment criteria.
You mean the mile? The mile?
Yeah.
Including the suburbs?
The mile is about 5 kilometers.
The suburbs, you know, lots of things can happen in the suburbs that no one hears anything about.
Right.
In an apartment house, probably not. So I just wonder whether or not the notion of the walled city that comes from the Torah seems to be really defined in sort of a functional way of density that seems to be not consistent with this interpretation. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's look at it another way. Maybe they don't want the 11th and 12th and 13th to really become the way we really handle all this. So
I understand other things. I'm just saying, I'm just looking for what defined a walled city. What can we learn from what the Torah says that would give us some guidelines for determining what constitutes a walled city?
Right. I mean, that's a nice way of bringing in a text that they didn't bring in here. If you want to make the assumption that there's certain density of population because of the practice that was called for in such a scenario, and that could impact the way we judge whether or not a city once, you know, either was once walled or still has the current density necessary to call itself walled in our time, even if it was quote unquote walled in the past, whether it's Achash Verosh's time or Yoshua ben Nun's time. We haven't really created a set of measuring sticks that said, quote unquote, it's more about whether you were an urban center or not. But that direction that you're suggesting now could very well have been a direction if people were thinking more in terms of population centers and densities of population.
From a practical point of view, if we say that in the villages they read or heard the Megillah reading, on the 14, or on the day when they assembled in the village, or market day, or whatever. Mm-hmm. If you live within a 10-minute walk of a major city, you're not likely to have a market in your place. You're likely to be in the market in the city
right.
itself.
Right, which was the reason why originally they expanded it to 11, 12, 13.
So a suburb of a city, for practical purposes, for purposes of going to court, of transacting business and so on, would tend to do it in the city.
Right, I mean, and that's really why in the early practice, we probably see a little bit of the early practice versus later practice coming through both vis-a-vis the Mishnah and the Gemara, right? The earlier practice, meaning the 11, 12, 13 expansion to have days you can read it earlier, and the 14, 15 being the days that are, you know, more quote-unquote ideal and named in the Megillah. And then this potential expansion into these areas, 5 square kilometers, could have reduced the need to expand the early direction and kept it on the 2 days of 14 and 15.
Yeah. The whole idea we were speaking of before of if there's been a tradition to read a word this way, then you should read it again that way, that you can't apply that if it has existed before but it hasn't been your teacher's practice to do so. You know, is interesting. And it's sort of like, it doesn't say you can't come up with anything new. It more says if it's come up before and your school, your teacher hasn't adopted it, you can't later. It makes me think a little bit about what do you do with the rice and the Seder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's not a new thought. It's been out there, but it hasn't been our practice or, you know, this school's practice. Can you adopt it later? You know,
right. Where does it become a potential way of reading, of living, of expressing your commitment as a reader, your commitment to the verse, from which they're learning either the yes or the no of rice, right? Because if it's all about, in some which way, being loyal readers or loyal subjects
right.
to, you know, God, that's an interesting question about when those things happen.
Right. And can you come up, it almost makes it easier, more legitimate to come up with something new, if it's truly new, than it is to adopt an older practice that you haven't previously adopted.
All right, so since we're talking about rice for a minute, Persians have a lot of rice. Sephardic have a lot of rice. We don't. One time it's mentioned in the Middle Ages as a minhag shtut, as a nonsense kind of practice, a nonsensical custom. Because now we understand how to package lentils differently from barley. We have enough technical expertise to separate grains of wheat from, say, whatever this kidney oat is. And we wouldn't really mess up. We should eat it. Right now in Israel, the current rabbin is going to have to think about how to deal with that. Because you have the food that's ochle kidney, you have the food that's not for those who eat rice, for those who don't eat rice. Meanwhile, the question about Megillah reading back to our Gemara is, you know, what do I do if by archaeological evidence I'm now living in a city in Israel where they find out through some type of archaeological experiential dig that at one point it was walled? That will be an interesting case.
Orthodox rabbinical will not accept the finding.
That will be an interesting case. You know, when that comes, we'll perk up. All right. Want to get into the next part of the Gemara? The next part of the Gemara turns, and it's now going to be a whole different topic, because you had one teaching from Rabbi Yirmiah, or Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba. The Gemara is going to quote another. But it's not just happenstance, and it's not just his name. How often in the Megillah do I have verses that deal with, quote-unquote, writing? Well, we know that the Melech is Kotev, writes a lot of things and sends them out, right? The end of the first chapter in the Megillah, he sends that out, rules that every Baal, every husband is the master of his house, and he says, V'yishlach Sfarim al kol medinot ha-melech, and he sends out these Sfarim, these
books.
Well, books in modern Hebrew, but at least scrolls, el medina, to all the different provinces, kichtava, in its own language, in other words, where you had these different kinds of pluralistic rulers, in a certain way they were pluralistic, right, because everybody had their own language still, and everybody had their own keys, their own writing, ve'el am va'am, kilshono, and according to each people, it's appropriate language. Liyot kol ish sorer beveto. He would be the one who is sorer beveto. He would be the one who is master of the house. Midaber kil shonamo. And it comes out in the language of the people. End of the Megillah. V'tichtov Esther Amalka. Esther writes. The queen writes. And v'tich Tov Esther Amalka Vat Avichayel Umordechai Yehudi Et Kol Tokef Lekayem Et Igeret Apurim Azot Hasheni. So, who's a literate woman? Esther. There's an ancient language of Hebrew mentioned here at this time. We know that it's even more ancient than this, but the idea that in chapter 1 and in chapter 9. There's the importance of the idea of writing and writing sfarim and writing scrolls and writing translatable codific law even. Remember I said at the first shiur that I believe that the Megillah in a certain way is early, early on rabbinic, almost quote-unquote rabbinic literature of agada and storytelling and law making and even apodictic codific lawmaking by this chapter, and how is it translated to the people around the provinces? It's translated through the transmission of oral and written, particularly, and written text by our people, as if to say that the king's writing is secondary to the Jewish writing that would take place, the lawmaking and the triumphant nature of what it means to have God on our side, have the Jewish people stand up for its right and defense. That's why the next section of the Gemara, even though it's not going to talk anything about the early writings of the king, it's not going to talk about Esther's writing, it's not going to talk about the way that we wrote those texts, what did they look like, how were they, that's not why I gave this little bit of an introduction. It's going to be that we're going to talk about Ivri. We're going to talk about ancient script. We're going to talk about the letters. We're going to talk about the writing of scrolls. We're going to talk about what we use to read in the synagogue. We're going to talk about going to the Torah down the line in Masechet Megillah. This particular passage on 2b4 is talking about the final letters of the alphabet. So I'm just going to pass this around. Next handout for the night. Oh, you have to see. This is the history of the Hebrew alphabet coming around. Okay. So the Gemara says the following. I'm on 2b4. Va'amar Rabbi Yirmiah, ve'item Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba. And Rabbi Yirmiah said, and others say it was Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, who says the following, Mansapach, Sofim Amarum. Mansapach. Now, if you didn't know what Mansapach was, you might think it was a word. Except that it's an acronym that does mean something, and it's the five letters that have final forms in the alphabet. So quickly take a look. I pass you out the chart. Now, find Mem, and then right underneath it, you see that there's a final Mem, right? Find Nun. You see underneath it, there's a final Nun. Find Sadi. You see that there's a final Sadi. By the way, some people say Sadik. Because, why? Because we just love tzaddiks in our tradition. But really, it's tzaddi. All right, tzaddi and final tzaddi. Then we have pei or fei and final fei. And then we have chaf. Okay, so those are the five letters that if we were looking at a chart and you have a poster of this or you get the chart off the internet like I pulled it for you, you would say, of course, those are the final letters. But we're living at a time and or we're retrojecting to a time where it wasn't so determined. Maybe the final form is not the final form. Maybe the other one is the final in terms of the Hebrew alphabet. Maybe they're not written exactly like they should be. Maybe we have to figure out what they should look more like, right? By the way, just in terms of this chart, Rashi's script, right? Mm-hmm. Not the script that Rashi wrote in. The print face that was used by the typesetters to offset Rashi's commentary in a printed book. Right? So, let's read in the Gemara again. So who actually, the forms of the Mem, the Nun, the Tzadi, the Pei, the Kaf were instituted by who? Tzofim Amarum. So the Tzofim, what do we use the word Tzofim for in the modern Hebrew? Scouts. Tzofim. But Tzofim is a word used in ancient times for prophets. Why?
Because they were observed. They
saw. They're seers. Right? They scouted out the land and saw what was necessary and told over what was necessary to the people. So they were instituted by the prophets. The Gemara is going to now challenge that on two levels. V'tispara? Is it reasonable to say that these forms were instituted by the prophets? Okay, I just want to point out, I forgot, I wanted to say about Rashi. Tzofim Amarum, when he says prophets said them, he adds one word, one more than I did, right? Rashi says Tzofim Amarum, it's the last Rashi on the page, in the bottom left-hand corner. Nevi'ei Hadorot. So what's he mean by Hadorot? Sometimes you have to ask on a Rashi, generates rate. Prophets of the generations. So we don't really know, he didn't name specific prophets. He just said prophets in general. Just important as by way of saying, we didn't get a name. Just saying that the prophets, over the prophetic period, we got these. But Tisbara, is it reasonable to say that these forms were instituted by the prophets? V'hachetiv elaham mitzvot. But it's written that these are the commandments. Meaning what? Leviticus 27:34, when it says these are the commandments, implies a certain amount of finality. I can't say that the prophets can start bringing me more. She'ein navi rashai l'chadesh davar me'ata. That a prophet doesn't have the permission to really introduce anything new from now on. And after the Sinaitic revelation, nothing could be changed. V'od. And now here's another challenge. Ha'amar rechisa. And I have a Rav Chista teaching that says, Mem v'samech shebeluchot. That the letters Mem and Samech of the tablets of the law, meaning the Aseret HaDibrot, B'nes Hayu Omdin. They were standing there, and it was a miracle how they were actually on the stone tablets. Why? The final Mem and the Samech, if it's contiguous all the way around, which it has to be. Right. So it was, in essence, all the way through. And the little center part of the Mem Sofit and the Samech
miraculously
stood in its place. And if I already have the final Mem and the letter Samech in their places, then this final Mem form, at least I could say I know it's in its final place. Right? I saw it written on the Ten Commandments. So what they're saying is that letter appears on the Ten Commandments. Mitzrayim. What's going to start the word? This kind of Mem. What's going to end the word? The final Mem. I see its place. I see it standing there. Says Rav Chisda, I know what's final. So the prophets didn't really put them into place. We already knew. Oh, the Gemara says, Ein mihava havu. Yeah, that's correct. Both forms of the letters, Mem, Nun, Sadi, Pei, and Kaf, did exist at the time of Moses. Velo havu yod e heba emtza teva veheba sof teva. But they didn't know which form belongs in the middle of a word and which at the end of a word. The atu sofim, and to enlighten the people who forgot which letters came at the beginning and which at the end, even though I had both these letter forms for these five letters, they came, but takinu ketuchin be'emtza teva. They put the open ones, or the ones that they call the non-final forms, which are called ketuchin, in the middle of the word, and they put stumin b'sof teva, and the ones that are closed at the end of the word. Now, obviously, the mem is the one that's really closed looking, right? But okay. Okay.
But
samach is not for the end of a word.
You can use
it for the end of a word. But what I'm saying is that when you think about the mem of the mansapach, nun doesn't get a closed circle in any which way. Tzadi doesn't get a closed circle. Okay, it has a longer line. But okay, so if the longer line is what you mean by stumin, that's not full and circular, but it's somehow closed looking, I could say that the nun and the chaf and the pei have longer lines. My problem is, what? That the mem doesn't have a longer line. That's just got a circle. The tzadi does. But okay, so it doesn't, can't mean just one thing, in other words. It's got to be both.
So what is the significance?
The significance is this. In the final analysis, sof-sof, Eila mitzvot, these are the commandments, she'ein navi atid l'chadesh davar me'ata, that a navi doesn't really completely introduce anything new. Eila, rather, what do you really say is happening here? Shechachum b'chazru v'yistum, that people had forgotten where they really were used, the proper place to use what we call a middle kind of letter and an ending letter, a sof, a final letter, and they reinstituted them. And that is, they had forgotten which form was at the end, and the prophets reinstituted is the explanation of the Schottenstein.
Well, it's interesting that in the other tradition, Eliyahu and Aramaic, there are no final ones. This is only a Hebrew.
Right.
Forms are not in these other languages.
So if you look at the ancestral, right, so we see that at some point there was a development. The question that we were dealing with before and talking about what, when something new and how can we bring it over and when can it start being used and can we say that it's ours and can we take it into our, this is the question also of Hebrew as a developing language.
It's living.
And, you know, when you take a look at the development of over time, and you think about what the rabbis are arguing about now in terms of the Gemara, who really put them into play? Was it the prophets? Or did we already have it by Moshe's time and the prophets just reminded? This all is a matter of discussion about who we ascribe it to. Even if we can't exactly say ourselves, this person at this moment. And yes, we accept it.
And since things were written without punctuation and without space, it would have been nice to have a final for all of them, although I guess not every, I don't know if every one is at the end of a word in Hebrew. I'm not sure whether that's the rule. But it would have been a good indicator to have a final to know the end of every word if you're going to put them all together. And I have heard it said that sometimes the vav is an indicator not just of and, but that it was the end of a sentence when you have a vav. Did you ever hear that?
Well, the vav in the Tanakh can act as what's called a vav contiguous, a vav mamshicha, where it's not per se and, it is indicating continuous action within a story that's being told from the position of someone telling it as if it's happening in this moment, or if it happened back then, and I'm telling you from a historical kind of perspective. So it's not and it's just, you know, then after that, in other words, the vav is very useful in that continuous action sequence.
So okay. I'm just saying that having definitely a final letter that changes the end.
Yeah, it could have been a very interesting.
Very useful because of the way, because of ancient writing.
Right. So just in my last 2 minutes, I'm sorry, I just got a little bit, I think, did it get a little, if you take the first handout I gave tonight and you open it up, you see that I brought you a page or two from this book called Language in Time of Revolution. And there's a revival of written Hebrew at a certain point in Europe and the Pale. And there's just a little bit here about how some of the hopes to revive Hebrew were in poems and Lithuanian poetry, and there were some plans about how to bring it back to life, and there obviously was an acceptance already of this, you know, serif font, and if you will, you know, the regular Hebrew alphabet in modern Hebrew. But the thoughtfulness of which era of Hebrew a certain linguistic style would follow was already in those mastering what would become, you know, a new reborn modern Hebrew at the time of Yiddish literature and then moving into Hebraic literature. Point being that one might have, could have thought that the revolution of modern Hebrew would have led, in many ways, like you're saying, Bobby, maybe we needed final letters at a certain point and they would all be constructed and people would have read a little bit more easily. Maybe someone would have suggested in the revolution of the rebirth of the Hebrew language that we needed some new form, that we needed some new letter, we needed to add something, we needed to change a style, a script. But in fact, we had so much by way of textuality that was sacred to ourselves, and Hebrew as a tool, even if it was going to become a secular tool of poetry, language that we could make economic deals with in a time that Jewish nationalism was being created, literally being created, we didn't really add or develop anything else. If the prophets were the ones to do it, because during that time of trying to create a certain nationalistic fervor and a hopeful nature of Jewish people and that God would restore us, and they did give us some type of new way of learning text or stopping to know what's the end of a word here, and they needed to bring us back to a certain kind of readership of their text. It's possible to think about it in terms of a time of prophetic revolution, is all I'm saying, and either that having been an era where we did get change and growth, or it was just a reminder, just like the modern Hebraists were reminding themselves of all types of beautiful Hebraic language with which to refresh and renew the national spirit of the Jewish people. A couple pages of reading. If you're interested, it's a wonderful book from the Stanford University Press called Language in Time of Revolution about Hebrew and its rebirth. Erev Tov.
You think it was inevitable that Hebrew would be the language of...
I think